Now, boys, our next guest is a bloke I crossed paths with on the cricket field over 30 years ago when he was keeping for Northcote Seconds. I remember him as being rather chatty and quite tenacious behind the stumps, and he's carried that tenacity into a battle with cricket administrators for a return to the back foot no ball rule for all sorts of reasons. Doug Ackerley, welcome to the locker room.
Well, thank you very much, Greg.
Now, mate, chatty and tenacious, am I doing you an injustice, or is that a fair description of you during your playing days?
Yeah, no. When you have no ability, you do have to have both those other qualities. You have to be tenacious, and most wicketkeepers should chat. And it's interesting, isn't it, that in fact part of the demise of the New South Wales keeper was not necessarily his batting, but the fact that perhaps Matthew Wade chats a little bit more than he does.
Is that right? Well, listen, I've got to tell you just quickly, I was speaking to my brother Stephen during the week and telling him that we're going to be having a chat to you, and he remembers a third 11 game down at Rathmines Road Oval in Hawthorne. Late in the day, you were keeping to a spinner, looking desperately for a few late wickets, and Stephen reckons he had to go to the square leg umpire to ask him to make you shut up because you were appealing when the ball was mid-flight, which he found rather disconcerting. So he couldn't work out whether you just knew he was a crap batsman and went, you were just appealing in anticipation, or whether you were just being overly enthusiastic.
Now, Greg, I would dispute that. I never, ever did that. That's an exaggeration. Hyperbole typical of some of the people, and obviously members of your family at that particular stage. But certainly, probably, as soon as it got past the bat, yes, it was on for young and old then, absolutely. And between deliveries, I found a wonderful time to be able to relax. They tell you these days, of course, that you should... not switch off, but switch down. It's a philosophy they use, and umpires have to use it too. But for keepers, it's very important. And I used that time to give batting coaching. I just want to contribute to the game.
And you did it very important. You did it very well.
Nice
memory.
And timely advice.
But anyway, mate, look, you've got another fight on your hands these days. You've written a fantastic book called Front Foot: The Law That Changed Cricket. I read it during the week. It's a great read on a subject that I think it's fair to say you feel quite passionate about. Tell us a bit about it.
Yes, look, I do. I don't know whether I'm railing against the authorities, but I am most concerned, and I think there is the potential for legal action here. If cricket authorities, and you can go right to the ICC over this, perhaps the MCC, certainly the controlling bodies in each country, might find themselves with people taking action as professional cricketers under workplace health and safety, and perhaps at recreational level, where legal action may not necessarily be taken, but where parents may be less disposed to allowing their kids to play the game that we love, Australia's biggest summer sport, and that is cricket. And the reason is that the 1963 law change from the back foot no ball law to the front foot led to a fundamental change in bowling actions. And subsequent to writing the book, Greg, I found out a couple of cases with spinners as well. Certainly you could tell about the actions, but very quickly, in under the back foot law, bowlers, particularly Ray Lindwell, the back foot law said that if your back foot landed behind the bowling crease, which is where the line where the stumps are planted, by and large, although there are some subtleties in the wording of the law, which you will have read about, but once your back foot landed clear of and behind that bowling crease, you were home free. But what happened was that people like Lindwell developed a drag, skating on their back toe, and many old-timers will remember the metal toe caps that that bowlers used, which enhanced their ability to skate, as it were. And bowlers like Gordon Rourke and Ray Lindwell in particular, Freddie Truman, ended up with their front foot landing well in front of the popping crease. That's where the batsman stands. That's the line where stumpings and runouts are determined. And they were perceived to be gaining an advantage. They were bowling too short a distance towards the batsman. And so there was a four-year period from 1959 to 63 where they used a disc where the umpire would mandate that the bowler had to land the length of his drag, as it were, behind the bowling crease, or he would be called for a no ball. It was an attempt to make bowlers bowl roughly from the popping crease, which was then the notional line of fairness. But today, it is the mandatory criterion for no-balling. Now, we can talk about the decision-making side of the law, because people will have observed so often, particularly in the 2015 Ashes series, for example, where batsmen were dismissed by blatant no balls, and the batsmen were recalled after no balls had been picked up by the television monitor and, of course, the third umpire. So we're suggesting that the umpires out in the field haven't got enough time to watch the front foot land, which is 4 feet further down the track from the back foot, where they had plenty of time, and to be able to make their decisions as well. You know, it's quite clear some umpires just don't look at where the front foot is landing because they know that the third umpire and technology can pick it up.
Is that a problem, though, Doug?
I think it's rather embarrassing, isn't it? I suppose there's drama, isn't there? While the crowd waits to see whether, in fact, it is a no ball, and then of course all the other sort of DRS type things happening. I mean, it adds to the theatre, I suppose, but all it does is just further slow down the over rates, for example. Yeah. And of course, Richie Beno and Sir Donald Bradman were both vehemently opposed to the front foot law, and argued one of their main arguments was the proliferation of no balls that happened under the new law, because the West Indians in particular would overstep that popping crease, and they'd be ending up bowling, you know, 20 overs less in a day than was mandated. Of course, they normally had you out by then, and they didn't really care about being fine or anything. But people look at the law itself as being somewhat inadequate, the front foot law. There is less decision-making time for the umpire. His call of no ball is later than it was under the back foot law, so there's no chance of a free hit by the batsman, which we've seen introduced into the shorter forms of the game, and that's always a bit of fun to see a batsman able to hear a call early enough to swing with impunity. And that always, and that's something that Cipelli wrote in the foreword to the book, because he can remember Keith Miller doing something very clever that related to that call. But look, as Simon Taufel says at the end of the book, whether you use the front line or the back line for decision making really doesn't worry him in the least. But the main thrust of the book, Greg and Michael and Neil, is that the actions were changed fundamentally. When the front foot law came in, young kids would start measuring their run-up from the front foot. The mentality, it was in your mental periphery, if not your physical periphery, I must get my front foot down now. It cannot go over that front line. Whereas in the past, if your back foot was down, you were home free. And if your front foot landed in front of the popping crease, it didn't matter. Now, if you've got a line over which you cannot go, what happened was that this led to a concertinaing, if you will, of the bowling action. The delivery stride got shorter. The jump was introduced into the gather. So in the old days, where it would be just horizontal forces and with shoulders and hips aligned side on towards the batsman, and a beautiful sort of a release valve, as Peter Philpott describes it, you now had a situation where, with this line over which you cannot go, rather like a long jumper, it shortened the delivery stride and introduced a jump into the gather. The big spectacular leaps like Dennis Lilly and Hogg and Brett Lee and all these people. But the problem is they're going so fast and they're jumping so high, they're landing with forces between 5 and 8 times their body weight through that front foot. And so often with their shoulders and hips out of alignment. So you have what's known as counter-rotation in the spine, and that's where you get your lumbar stress fractures. And with Mitchell Starc at the moment, of course, who's had several instances of both, he has yet again another front foot stress fracture due to those incredible forces going down through his front foot. And, you go back, it can affect your shin as well, as happened with Imran Khan for quite a considerable time of his test period where he played a few as a batsman, but he just could not bowl because he had those stress fractures. And in Australia, with our rock-hard drop-in pitches in particular, and the imperative for pace in Australia, as opposed to in England where it's swing and seam and softer landing, you tend to see that our problem is just, it's out of control.
So you've got the sports science side of it, which you just described then really nicely, and obviously fast bowlers have got a view. You also interviewed some umpires. What's the umpiring perspective on the rules?
Yes, well, as far as umpires are concerned, those who umpired only under the front foot law, and Robin Bailash is one in particular, he cannot see why umpires can't have plenty of time to look at where the front foot lands and to be up in time to check for the bat pads, the court behinds and the LBs. So he's in fact a front foot proponent, and Robin, who lives down your way, he's probably about 80 years of age now, Robin. He's got no problem. Whereas Colin Egar, who was the man who umpired pretty well every test in Australia during the 60s, so therefore before and after the law change in 1963, he quickly worked out that he didn't have enough time under the new law, because he's losing at least 4 feet of decision-making time in the old measure, so a metre and a half probably. He continued to work off the back foot. And, of course, there were no side-on cameras in those days, so therefore they couldn't, prove Colin wrong on what television existed at the time. And so, therefore, if he knew that a certain bowler had, and he knew all the bowlers, and he knew roughly their stride lengths, he, therefore, just continued to work off the back foot, and he'd call no balls very sparingly if someone quite clearly, where his back foot had landed, his front foot was going to go well over the popping crease, which was the new criterion then. And Ross Duncan told me that his old umpiring mate, if you will, from up in Queensland, the policeman Lou Rowan, told him he did exactly the same thing. And Lou Rowan umpired pretty well every test with Col Egar in the 60s, certainly after the law changed. So they were practical about it. They reckoned they didn't have enough time to be up in time to see the court behinds and the LBs. So they operate off the back foot. Jack Collins, who's still going, of course, and you'd have been umpired by him, I think, Greg, in district cricket, and he umpired test cricket and World Series, of course, famously for Packer. Jack's a backfoot man, but of course he started umpiring in the late 40s. He didn't play terribly much. He was an umpire almost from the word go, and so it probably depends on what era you come from.
Yeah. So, Doug, where do you go from here so far as getting the powers that be in cricket administration to take this matter seriously, do you think?
Well, I've been having some good email correspondence with Mike Brearley in England, who is the chairman of the MCC's World Cricket Committee. They're an advisory body to the ICC, but they have at times, and their membership changes, and Mike's stepping down in July, so I'm going to have to work on Mike Gatting now, who's going to probably be the new chairman. But they've got Sean Pollock. I had some help from Sean and his father, who are both backfoot proponents. And Sean was on the committee, a highly respected man, as you know. Rahul Dravid, people like that have been on this committee. Rodney Marsh is still on it. Ricky Ponting is. These are people who think about the game and they have great standing in the game. And I might even go over, you know, they have their meeting in July, because I really don't want this swept under the carpet. There's been the odd person in the past who has actually burst into print and made this point that the law changed bowling actions, but it's been few and far between. Alec Bedser was the first, in fact, in 1990 to make this observation. But one thing that does annoy me is that, you know, all the back injuries we're having, of course, Stark has just been sent home now. Yet again, it's the third time he's had a stress fracture in his foot, and of course he was out for more than a year with a lumbar stress fracture. This thing, Nathan Coulter-Nile, Siddle, Pattinson, you just go through it. There's almost not a player in Australia who hasn't been affected by this. And when I read from sports scientists that workload is the problem I did a lot of work into a workload, and as you will have read in the book there, they haven't bowled, they've never bowled less in the history of representative cricket, Greg. So don't let's talk workload. And of course they say, oh look, once you reach 24, skeletal hardening will mean that you know, your bones have hardened by the age of 24, roughly, and you'll be pretty right after that. Your body can tolerate a certain amount of counter-rotation. Well, try telling Peter Siddle that at the age of 32, because he hasn't bowled a ball in anger for a year. Yeah. And, of course, Pattinson and Stark are well past 24 now.
Indeed.
And it's just becoming embarrassing. So I really want to... I will keep at this because I do want authorities to take note. And, I mean, if Pat Cummins were to break down again now, I mean, what would your reaction be to that?
Yeah, exactly right. Doug, you make a fascinating point. It's a book called The Front Foot, The Law That Changed Cricket. We appreciate talking. We have to keep moving. We appreciate chatting with you today. And no doubt a few people will now delve into that one and have a decent read. So we appreciate your chat and we appreciate all the research you put into that one.
Well, I appreciate your interest in having me on, Greg and Michael and Neil. Thank you so much. And, yeah, look, go out and buy it in your local store and have a look through it, because it goes into the full history of why the law changed, the first half of the book. Then we look at it as a decision-making tool, and then the last half a dozen chapters are going right into the full history of all the people who've broken down and the theories as to why. And I'm absolutely convinced there's no doubt it was the law change. And unless we get back to the back foot law, it will just continue on and on and on. And it won't matter what the sports scientists do, they will not be able to fix it.
We're all good books are sold, and all bad ones too, I bet, Doug.
Thanks, Doug.
Indeed, I love those bad books, too, because they stock it, and sometimes they discount it. They're very, very bad.
Thanks, Doug.
Cheers, mate. Cheers.